Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Amy Ichikawa. She was formerly incarcerated in California. She recently founded the nonprofit organization Woman to Woman, Inc. That's woman, woman to woman, two as in Roman number, Woman to Woman, Inc. This organization was originally created as a resource hub for reentry services, but has become much more after California's SB 132, quote, the Transgender Respect, Agency, and Dignity Act, end quote, which has allowed gender self-ID in prisons, creating an unbelievable violation of human rights. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
So a lot of people might not have any idea what you're talking about with any of this. Can you... first off, can you just very quickly say what is reentry services? And then after that, can you talk about SB 132 and what is happening in women's prisons?
For sure. Reentry services for formerly incarcerated or incarcerated individuals is my connections with transitional housing services, different programs that are available. I wanted to make those things more accessible for women because when I paroled, for example, I didn't have any idea what kind of resources were available to me. It wasn't made known prior to my release. So I kind of went at this blind. And I had no idea really how much being incarcerated had affected me mentally, emotionally. I was very unprepared for coming into the world post-incarceration. And the services I want to provide are things that most people wouldn't think of. When you get out of prison after you've served an extended period of time, say for 20 years, for example, you don't know how to use a phone. You don't know how to get an Uber. You don't know how to order a coffee when you go to Starbucks. All of those things that seem really basic and in turn are very essential aren't something that these women are familiar with. And I want to be able to help them learn just these basic things with dignity without having to feel embarrassed or stupid like I did. It was embarrassing. You know, the first time I went to Chipotle, I freaked out and ran out because it looked just like the chow hall inside. So being able to connect them with a partner who understands, who's been through the transition, it was my goal initially. But after SB 132 came into play, I realized there was something that was definitely a priority, which was women's safety. SB 132 has left a huge gap for violent sex offenders to slide into women's prison under the guise of being non-binary or gender non-conforming. The law is kind of disguised because the name sounds really nice, you know, respect, agency, dignity. Those are all great things that everybody deserves, that everybody needs to have. But it's not just, this isn't a transgender law. This isn't a transgender bill. This actually includes anyone, intersex, non-binary. Let me see. Anything aside from the gender that you have on your birth certificate qualifies you to request a gender self-ID and transfer to a prison with which you identify with. There's little to no reasons for denial that aren't considered discriminatory. You can't base a denial on someone's criminal history, someone's sexual orientation, someone's anatomy, anything that would seem like a logical reason to keep someone out of a woman's prison is not allowed to be used. Meaning, if you're a violent serial rapist with a long history of violence against women and you're heterosexual, you qualify for a transfer.
So let's back up for a second. And why are prisons what would be some reasons for prisons to be sex segregated in the first place?
Well, mainly it would be safety issues. Men and women are very different, and men and women in hostile situations are very different. The culture in men's prison and women's prison is entirely different.
By the way, you should know that I taught for a few years at Pelican Bay State Prison. I taught creative writing.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. But so you know how that environment is. That's, you know, character, you know, that's one of the more notable prisons in California. I know it's changed a lot over the years, but that's actually where this bill was born. That's where a lot of the research was being done, and a lot of the interactions and surveys with the transgender community there helped to form the bill. But the culture is not comparable at all. And then the way prisons are separated, men are separated by levels. There's level 1, 2, 3, and 4. Women are not separated by any levels. We're all together. Levels of separation can be related to the nature of your crime, how many points you have in the system. There's all kinds of variables in there. And in women's prison, everybody is together because historically there haven't been any issues between, you know, murderers and people that are petty thieves. It's always worked. But
I had just a really quick example. I had a level one student. Level one is the least secure. They just had a chain link fence. Level four is the supermax. And I had a level one student who successfully sued the California Department of Corrections because he was messing around in a kitchen. He destroyed a piece of equipment just because he was being an idiot. And for punishment, they put him into level four for a while. And his cellmate in level four beat him and broke his back.
Wow.
And he successfully sued CDC over that. You know, the point is, level one, they play baseball, and level four, there's not a chance they're going to give anybody a baseball bat.
Absolutely not.
Anyway, so that's, I was just giving the example of, of potential violence in a men's prison.
It's something that is commonplace every day. Men wake up and they've got to prepare for war. It's not the same kind of environment women are used to. While I was in prison, there were very few, and there were incidences of violence, but in no way were they comparable to what happens in the men's prison. And what happens in women's prison when there is a violent incident is it affects the entire prison. When somebody gets assaulted, when there's a really bad fight, when there's a riot, which is not what you would picture it as, but when there's an assault, everyone is affected. It creates this just infectious air of fear. And that's what, you know, the prison runs off. Women are afraid. They're afraid. They're afraid to have their comforts taken away. They're afraid of standing up for their rights because they've been disappointed and broken so many times that they even now, even yesterday, I was speaking with somebody, and this spirit of hopelessness is starting to infect the population because they are realizing what we're up against, and they're afraid. The opposition has, you know, incredible lawyers. They have lots and lots of funding, and we don't. And they're just feeling defeated before we've even started the fight. And it's heavy. It's heavy.
So, in a moment, I'm going to ask you why. I'm going to ask you two questions. One is, in your experience, do women want men in their prison? Mm-hmm. Two, those who do not, why do they not want men in the prison? Just be explicit. But before that, I want to ask another question, which is, what percentage of women in prison do you believe were abused by men either as children or as adults? What percentage have undergone some sort of either sexual or physical? And let's sort of say or extreme emotional abuse, but especially physical or sexual. What percentage would you say have been abused?
I would like to say 100%. I would like to say 100% because I don't recall meeting a single person in the 5 years I spent in California State Prison who wasn't trying to recover from some kind of damage, whether it be physical, emotional, sexual, financial, some sort of abuse from a man, while they were children, adults, even while incarcerated. I would say everyone.
So I want to say one more thing, and then I'll shut up about this, that when I taught at Pelican Bay, one of the things that occurred to me was that it felt in many cases, and these are level four prisoners, people who are doing life for murder. Mm-hmm. And many of them, I thought the people who really should have been incarcerated were their fathers or grandfathers. Mm-hmm. Because many of them had themselves been abused severely as children. That's not to excuse anything they ever did, not in the slightest. I'm just talking about the pernicious effects of abuse. Mm-hmm. That I would guess that a significant portion of men in prison too have been abused by men.
Absolutely. And I think that there's not any amount of attention that's being given to that topic. The fact that this is something that's very dark and very deep and very horrible that's happening there, and it's not being addressed. It's just being shifted around. There are no mental health services for us. People go into the system and they're really messed up. And going to prison there is no rehabilitation in CDCR. It's that there aren't the services available for even people who want to change or who want to address the issues that are the reason for why they got there in the first place. It's the rehabilitation comes through your peers, peer counseling. That's the only way that I got through my sentence was depending on other people inside.
So thank you for that. And so let's go back to, we have a population, a literally captive population of women who have been abused at some point by men. And now let's continue. Go ahead.
And they don't, as soon as I made myself available, all of the messages I received were, I don't want them here. We don't want them here. We can't do this. Why are they doing this to us? We can't. How are we supposed to live like this? Do they not care about us? Who voted for this? I don't think anybody took into consideration the blueprint, the schematics of these prisons. CCWF has 8-man cells, 8-women cells. There's 8 people per cell in a cell that was designed to house 4 people, which now has 4 bunk beds. Thus 8 people. In that room, there's a shower, a toilet, and 2 sinks. So it's very intimate. There's very little elbow room. You're sharing 6 feet of space with your bunkie. And if this person is, a heterosexual sex offender, or regardless of what kind of sex offender or violent offender they are, if they're twice your size and they've been working out for the past 20 years, it's impossible to function. There's no way that people can even start to rehabilitate on any level when they're living in constant fear. There's women that have been abused so bad that even if another woman comes too close to them, they just shut down. Having the shower situation in another prison, CIW, for example, has communal showers. So I got a call the other day from somebody who was absolutely hysterical because she had just run out of the shower and left all her stuff in there because all of a sudden she heard voices and they weren't women's voices. This is just creating so much mental anguish. It's an even unhealthier environment than it was, a year ago. It's very demented. I don't know why more thought wasn't put into this kind of stuff, or why there wasn't some effort in providing preparedness for the women. Counseling should have been readily available, something, but they weren't taken into consideration. They were not interviewed. They were not surveyed. And it was stated by CDCR that everyone who was going to be affected by this bill was spoken to, and they took the survey to make sure that their rights were being taken into consideration. And these courtesies included everyone except women. And they're the ones who are affected by this 100%, 24 hours a day.
So a concern I have is that there are males who have ID'd as transgender and are considered by all the organizations to be, quote, trans women, end quote, mm-hmm. who include serial killers of women, yep. who include, like, Donna Perry in Washington, who is housed with women. Yeah. He's killed multiple women. Karen White in the UK, who is a rapist, who has raped multiple women in prison. And so on. Anyway, so any response to that?
Absolutely. You know, the consensus from my peers and my firm belief is that there should be no acceptance to the rule that nobody with a history of violence towards women, nobody with any sexual offenses against women should even be able to think about transferring in. It makes no sense whatever category they fall under, if they are historically known to be violent against women, there's no reason why they should be able to reside in a women's facility. It's completely nonsensical. It's making women completely worthless and making this person's feelings way more of a priority than a whole population of women's safety.
When I taught, which was back in the early 2000s, there were rules in place that would protect vulnerable male prisoners from other males. Mm-hmm. For example, to get out of SHU, they had to go through I don't remember what it's called. It wasn't deprogramming, but it was a debriefing system. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they would be considered snitches. So there was like entire
yards
devoted simply to them to protect them. And also, I know that sometimes child molesters are put into ADSEG, administrative segregation, mm-hmm. to protect them, because a lot of them would have there would be a kill on site. And also I remember that there was the whole question of Northerns versus Southerns, mm-hmm. that those gangs, I don't know if they still do, but at that point, the Northerns and the Southerns had a kill on site relationship. Mm-hmm. And so there would be various protections in place for that. And my understanding is that up until at least recently, that was a program that would simply work, as you simply either keep them in ADSEG, the males who identify as transgender, you mm-hmm. would keep them in ADSEG, or you would put them into yards with other vulnerable populations. Mm-hmm. So did that system work, or was that?
Historically, it was okay. There's SNY yards, special needs yards, for people with sensitive needs or who are in danger, but that also included, like you said, the dropouts and the rats. So
the point is,
they said it was discriminatory because being transgender, why should you be punished and be segregated with the rats? It wasn't seen as a protective move anymore. It was then deemed discriminatory, and they wanted to be, integrated with the population of whom they identified with.
Well, okay. I'm sorry to be just stupid, but what if you identify as innocent? I mean, you can identify.
Exactly. Exactly. I identify as free. So can you give me the keys?
I identify as level one.
Uh-huh.
It's
I identify as the warden. I mean, to what end? What end is this? Where is this going to stop?
So the point is that I'm not saying that sexual assaults don't occur in men's prisons or mm-hmm. regular assaults don't occur in men's prisons, because of course they do. And I've seen videos of them. Mm-hmm. And through my training, I had to watch some videos of stuff. So I would know to dive under a table when that happened. Yeah, exactly. And so it sounds like, I mean, if is what you're saying that the problem was one of a lack of validation of their identity rather than actual physical safety, that the primary concern, because if they're already in ADSEG, mm-hmm. they just feel like they're being punished, but that's still they're physically relatively safe, or am right. I wrong?
Well, they're protected. They're completely separated from the threat. This is about, you know, inclusion and feelings and, you know, taking all these, I don't know when exactly this shift happened, but the fact that feelings are so much more important than facts, statistics, and everything now is really the most dangerous thing I've ever seen happen in our country. I mean, when I was younger, our whole thing was F your feelings, you know. It wasn't about feelings. It was action. It was facts. And those kind of things aren't being taken into consideration. It's very unrealistic. It's kind of like whimsical lawmaking. I mean, there are, it's limitless the way the law is written. You can say you're anything. The umbrella term of transgender that was used by legislation has included all kinds of terms I've never even heard before. Two-spirit, mehu, I don't know those things, but this is actually in the California law.
So I presume that there are laws and regulations that are written out specifically as to, for example, when lights go off or when you eat. Is that true?
You mean like implemented by staff or by other inmates?
Well, the point is that law is based on definitions. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I mean, even something as simple as parking in a no parking zone, they have to define a no parking zone.
Right.
Or I had students who were in for first degree murder, and you have to define first degree murder, and you have to define murder, and mm-hmm. they had to define what is level one, what is level two. All of these things are based on rigorous definitions, mm-hmm. rigorous objective definitions is the point. Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
And that's lacking. That's lacking. That was one of the first things I noticed when I finally read the bill in full. The first thing I noticed was the definition is so broad and there's such a huge gray area and it's so inclusive that it's dangerous. It's very reckless. The fact that you can't take someone's criminal history into consideration when you're referring to somebody because they decide that they're non-binary or gender fluid is insanity. That everybody is going to take it, or not everybody, but many people are going to take advantage of this, and they already have. If you know, it's public information. The people who are there, who have transferred from men's facilities, their cases are all, a lot of them are sex related. A lot of them are rapists. A lot of them are child molesters. And the fact that can't be taken into consideration before finding them suitable for transfers is wild. And just like you said, the lack of definition, the lack of a definitive example of what CDCR considers transgender is completely creating the issue that we have now. There's no rules. It could be anybody. It's under the guise of transgender. So if anybody's against it, you are then a transphobe. And that's not the case at all. It was a great tool. This was very well thought out. It was an amazing plan. And this took a lot of of creativity to manipulate this to where it's bulletproof. It's incredible.
So give me insofar as you're comfortable with this, give me a few of the stories that you have heard from women of either their concerns or what has happened.
Well, a couple weeks ago, it's so sad, you know. I thought maybe I was going to get mad at first, but that's not what happened. But there were people that were actually like having sex on the yard, like just on the yard. And the story, or, you know, the gossip is that this lady's a lifer. She's a lifer and she just wanted to have a baby. And we all know that doesn't make sense, and that's not a really healthy decision to make. But it happened. And almost, you know, I don't know how we know, but there's a lot of people in men's prison that've got HIV. And these people are getting these transfers, coming in, actually having sex on the yard. And it's traumatizing, you know, for the women that looked out their window and saw this. It's, you know, I don't even know how to describe the feeling. I just kind of dropped the phone when I was reading messages, because it's exactly what we predicted. It's the worst. But the sense of hopelessness, the feeling of worthlessness is not something that I'm able to offer a whole lot of comfort, because that's exactly what this is saying. This is proving to them that they are not valuable, that they don't matter. There's other situations where the transfers are aggressive. There's a young lady, I mean, the people are standing so close to you or them in line for whatever the case is, phone sign up, midline, that you can feel somebody's penis in your back. That's in no way, that's not acceptable out here. That's not acceptable in there. That's a complete invasion of someone's personal space, privacy. And who's what that's going to do to her afterwards? This is somebody who's trying to recover from years of abuse, who now is, I feel like that's assault, is being assaulted while incarcerated, and she's helpless and she can't do anything. And who do they run to? Who do they talk to? Who do they make these reports to? Because, you know, there hasn't been a whole lot of support from staff. There are some who are super sensitive to the situation, but a lot of them are angry. They didn't want this to happen. They're not cool with the situation. Nobody wants to have to do extra work. And a lot of these officers have never worked in a men's facility before. So they're having to go through additional training, and they're going to have to do a lot of paperwork because there's going to be a lot of incidents. But let me think, what's another one recently that was totally unacceptable? They're not checking people for co-defendants, victims, how dangerous of a situation that is.
Amy, can you back up? Can you back up like two sentences, because the Zoom crapped out for a second?
Where was I?
You said they're not checking people for co-defendants, and that's the last I heard.
They're not, before the transfers are initiated, there's no monitoring whether or not they have co-defendants in the facility or wives or victims. There's no research being done. And that seems, you know, like something that would be done quite obviously before you move somebody into another facility. But there's no reason why I should get calls and women are like, oh my gosh, my co-defendant just is in receiving. What am I supposed to do? You know, I'm running out of little words of encouragement and ways to you know, kind of extinguish the fear, because I'm scared too. This doesn't make sense. How were those things overlooked? They weren't. I don't think they were. It really feels like this was written by intelligent people. So I don't think those things were overlooked. I don't think women's safety was overlooked. It feels very intentional.
So are you saying that you could have a woman who was abused by her partner, mm-hmm. who is incarcerated, and then her perpetrator was also incarcerated, perhaps separately, mm-hmm. and now it is possible for him to be transferred into her prison?
Yes. And it's happening. And it's not just like, you know, random low profile cases. There's people that are coming off of death row to do their time in women's facilities.
So my father was extremely violent. He broke my sister's arm. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. And I've written about this in multiple books. And one of the reasons I moved out of Colorado was because I didn't want to be in the same state as him, because I didn't want to go to the grocery store and be afraid I would see him. And this is me having been away from my perpetrator for many years. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm just saying, let's take this. And instead of, I mean, I left the state of Colorado because of him.
Right.
And now imagine if you're being put into a prison, or I'm sorry, if you're in a prison and your perpetrator is put into the same prison.
And you can't get away. And there's nothing but a chain link fence that's separating you. And you don't know if tomorrow you're going to wake up and that person's going to walk into your unit and by their right, because of SB 132, can say, I want to be in that room. I don't feel safe with any of these people in here. So I need them all out except for her. That is a real situation that could happen. Yes, she can refuse, but then what? She's going to get in trouble for refusing to lock it in. And that could definitely affect her parole suitability or affect her date. There's so many different fear factors that come into play. This is real. You can definitely expect situations like this to become commonplace.
So you mentioned fear, and a lot of people, including J.K. Rowling, who speak up even mildly about these issues, receives standard threats of violence, of death if they're males, and rape and death if they're women. Mm-hmm. And are you scared? I know you're doing it, but are you scared at all to speak out? You can also not answer that question if you don't want to.
I mean, yes and no. I know that there's a huge risk, and I know that I am putting myself in the crossfire, but it's not even close to what the girls are going through. So if I have to be the center of you know, people's misdirected hate in order to bring awareness to what's going on in women's prisons, I'm okay with it.
So I heard a rumor, and you can tell me if this rumor isn't true. I heard a rumor about removing trees at the prison. Is that true?
There's no more trees.
So can you tell that story?
I think that over the years they've started the tree removal. So
so that doesn't have to do with this.
Not necessarily, but it was written, I think I saw a memo or something about it, that there was a potential that weapons could be formed from, you know, trees and tree material. So any remaining trees needed to be removed. But that was never an issue. Like for the last 30 years in Chowchilla, it was never an issue until now. So this is like direct admission that there is going to be considerable safety risks. There's been other examples, but that was really depressing, because the trees, I know it seems like something that's not really that big of a deal, but when you're in a place that's completely void of anything even reminiscent of home, the shade, being able to go outside and, you know, lean up against a palm tree, or, you know, walking past the honor dorm and being able to see roses or the rosemary bush. It's those are little comforts that help you get through your time. And from what I understand, it's just very desolate. It's even more desert-like than it was before. And I mean, it made me really sad, because those were one of the things that I remember the most. I took a really long look out my window the day before I paroled to try and memorize, you know, the yard, the way it looked. And it's gone. It's just desolate. So, and it's already so desolate emotionally. So now it's just like the canvas is very well matched to the emotions there. So,
So far as nature helping prisoners, I had a student who was in SHU, and one day he was being transported to or being walked to the infirmary, and as he was walking, a dragonfly flew right next to him, and he said that the dragonfly was one of the most important. That little encounter, it was the first non-human he had seen in like literally years, because he'd been in SHU, and that was one of the most important encounters of his life. So if you could have a tree with birds in it, that would make your really unhappy life a tiny bit less unhappy, it would seem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very much so. I remember it was towards the end of my fourth year, and there were pigeons, and my bunkie came running to the room and said, "Oh my God, Itchy, there's pigeons outside." And I'm like, "Okay, great. What is, okay." And she said, "Amy, I haven't seen pigeons in 20 years, you know?" So it's very significant. It is a really big deal. Even the lizards in, you know, CIW are forms of comfort, because there's just a reminder that there's life outside with something as small as a bug or a lizard or a breeze or some shade from a tree. These are just the little things that people find so much comfort in. Just like the dragonfly. There was a bird that used to follow me. There was actually an owl a big white owl that used to follow me when I would go to work in the morning at like 4 o'clock in the morning. And I don't know. I thought it was my special friend. It's just, it's little things like that help you have kind of a little vacation from the constant stress and trauma that you're under while you're there.
So we have about 10 minutes left. And before I really start to ask you to wind down, can you raise issues that I haven't asked the correct questions for? What else do you want to talk about before we talk about what you are trying to do about this, what women are trying to do about this, and what can be done about this? Before we go there, are there other things you want to talk about with this issue?
I think I feel comfortable. I think we covered it. I think you got into the more emotional side of the whole law. There is a human side to all of this, and it has been overlooked for women, not for anybody else, just for women. And I think we got into it. We did a good job.
So, and the males who come in who identify as transgender, I mean, it's not that they're being put into a special wing of the women's prison by themselves. I mean, it's always stunning to me that no matter whether it's a sports issue, a bathroom issue, a locker room issue, or prison issue, it's always the women who have to pay for it. It's like, oh my God, we have to take care of these males who identify as transgender because they're under such danger. But nobody ever talks about the danger to women. Never, never, never. And if you bring it up, then you must be a bigot.
Right. You're a total transphobe. You can't say that. You can't say that. Because, you know, I think our laws are not designed to protect women and children anyway. They're always designed to protect men, their investments and businesses. So men who are now women definitely have an opportunity to look great in women's rights, way better than they ever looked on us. It's something that isn't being addressed. Why are men not being encouraged to be more inclusive of their gender fluid community? You know, why instead of forcing us to be inclusive, why aren't they forced to be less exclusive? It's something I don't know if we'll ever find the answer to, but it's the heart of the issue. This is what's going to happen everywhere. It's not going to be limited to women's prisons soon.
So what are you doing to oppose this? What are other people doing to oppose this? And what do you want listeners of this interview to do about the issue?
Well, first, most importantly, they can visit stopsb132.com. Help us by signing the petition. You know, we're in close partnership with the Women's Liberation Front, who has taken us under their wing and guided us through this journey we were not prepared for at all. They've been extremely supportive. And so have, you know, the feminists in the UK have really been supportive too. Surprisingly, I wasn't expecting a lot of support from overseas, and that's where I got it. The women need encouragement. You know, I'm sending as much literature, information, books as I can, you know, within reason. There's our website, www.womaniiwoman.org, and that's where you can go for updates, actual letters from the ladies that are expressing their concerns, so that people can see this isn't just you know, my opinion or my feelings. This is the consensus. This is the actual connection. This is them. This is what they have expressed. And I've been very adamant about making sure that I'm not misspeaking or saying things that are just my beliefs. I want to make sure I'm representing them accurately and expressing what they really feel. And the website's got that stuff published. So if anybody needs to fact check, that's a great place to go. Another thing would be to contact, you know, Gavin Newsom or Senator Scott Wiener from San Francisco District 11, who authored the bill. That's important. You know, I don't know if he had any idea that this was going to happen, but he's a smart guy. He's got a lot of degrees, and I would like to think that he could have foreseen these dangers. But it needs to be brought to his attention that this isn't working out. This has to be amended. This has got to be amended with partnership from women. Decisions like this can't be made without taking us into consideration. It's very inhumane. So that's where you could start. We're working on a database. We're trying to make as much contact and stay in touch with as many people as possible, because there's not, like I said, mental health services available, and these women need to talk. They need to talk to somebody, and I can only take so many calls a day. So, you know, people are more than welcome to send me an email with ideas or make a donation so I can put some more money on my GTL account. That we're really doing our best, and I can't tell the girls enough times a day that we're trying, because I can only say so many things before they need action, you know? But this is where it starts: communication and awareness. And if, you know, one more person finds out what's going on in there today, then hopefully they can tell a couple more people, and it can just snowball from there.
So are the women, I think you've said this, but I just want to ask again, are the women, in the women's prisons that you've experienced or that speak to you, are they feeling Are they feeling forgotten by the public at large?
Mm-hmm. It's so heartbreaking every time I open a message and it says, I feel completely abandoned by the judicial system. I feel that we absolutely don't matter and that our lives have no value. It's really hard to explain to them that that's not true when this situation is proving that it is true. But, you know, I try and be as encouraging as possible because those kind of feelings are contagious and it's going to be an epidemic. And having an entire prison full of women that have given up is not acceptable.
Well, thank you for fighting for them. And is there anything else you want to say before we sign off?
Well, I want to thank you very much, Derek. Thank you for your interest. I'm really glad that we are connected, and you know, hopefully we can make a difference together and we can celebrate someday.
Well, thank you for all that, and thank you for fighting for the incarcerated women and for women in general. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Amy Ichikawa. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.